Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III. On today's program, we will discuss contemporary news media discourse concerning Russia with Dan Kovlik. We will then be joined by Chelsea Corby to discuss an upcoming documentary on fake news. Please stay with us. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring, an anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won, we got the love of the Thought Brothers.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. We are broadcasting from lovely Hayward, California. And I want to remind our listeners to come to the Media Freedom Foundation Summit October 26, 27, 2018 at College of Marin. Again, that's October 26, 27, 2018, the Media Freedom Summit, College of Marin. And I also want to remind our listeners, check the projectcensored.org/radio website. We always have new content up there, and rumor has it a Nick's Flicks is coming soon.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm. Amy, you're here to tell us more.
Hello, this is Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. On today's program, we will discuss contemporary news media discourse concerning Russia with Dan Kovlik. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners that every Friday you can get the latest Project Censored show before it hits the airwaves. Just go to www.projectcensored.org/radio. There, you can listen to any and all of the Project Censored shows and show your support for Project Censored. Also, please rate and like us on iTunes. It is a big help. If you enjoy the Project Censored show and the free content that we provide, just hit like on iTunes. Any feedback, questions, comments, concern can be directed to Twitter. Nolan can be found at Nolan_Higdon. Nick can be found at Dr. Dreadlocks. And Desiree can be found at Des_Blacktivist.
All right. Thank you, Amy. We're here again. Another school shooting.
That's right. As we record this program, another school shooting, this time in Texas, between Galveston and Houston at Santa Fe High School.
Eight dead?
Mm-hmm. Eight dead. Both the shooter captured and a person of interest captured as well.
So what do you think? What kind of backlash or reaction do you think we're going to get out of this, given what happened in Parkland?
None.
None?
No. I'm coming to the very quickly to the conclusion that America likes guns more than it likes kids. I don't think there's any other conclusion that you can make. That's just my sort of editorializing on this.
So you think this will just be part of the normal American experience? I mean, it has been for most of my life.
Yes. I mean, for example, if we think about the history of this, okay, and let me work backwards here. As we know, on February 14th of 2018, this year, we had 17 people killed at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. In January of this year, 2018, we had two students who were killed and 14 wounded by gunfire. This was in a Marshall County high school in West Kentucky. 15-year-old boy was the shooter. December 7th of 2017, two students at Aztec High School in New Mexico. September 13th, 2017, 15-year-old boy killed at Freeman High School in Rockford, Washington, and three female students who were wounded. 15-year-old boy, again, opening fire with a handgun. You're starting to see a theme here, right? 15-year-old boys and handguns. April 10th, 2017, gunman opened fire in the special education classroom that his estranged wife was running in North Park Elementary School in San Bernardino, killing an 8-year-old boy and wounding another child. September 28, 2016, a 6-year-old boy fatally shot on the playground of Townville Elementary School in South Carolina, shot by a 14-year-old boy who had also just killed his father. September 8, 2016, a 14-year-old girl died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound after shooting and wounding another female student at Alpine High School in West Texas. December 14, 2012, a 20-year-old gunman killing 20 first-grade children and 6 educators. This was Sandy Hook in Newtown, Connecticut, and then killing himself. He had also shot his mother before entering the school, just to get in a little bonus killing there. February 27, 2012, 3 students killed and 2 wounded in a shooting that started in a school cafeteria in Chardon, Ohio, as students waited for buses to other schools. Suspect was 17. April 16, 2007, 23-year-old Seung Hui Cho fatally shot 32 people in a dorm. This was Virginia Tech. I know people who were there, by the way, in 2007 at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. April 20th, 1999, Columbine High School in Littleton, Colorado. And December 1st, 1997, another notorious one, in West Paducah, Kentucky. Then 14, pleaded guilty but mentally ill to murder and is now serving life in prison. He killed three students and wounded five at a high school.
So you know what I find interesting when you read through that list? I remember two sort of national tragedies from my high school years. One was Columbine, and the other, of course, was 9/11. And I remember the reaction after 9/11 was, there's a pre-9/11 world and post-9/11 world. We have to change everything. Airplanes can be used as weapons, right? We have to change the whole way airport models are done, background checks, et cetera, et cetera. But guns in schools doesn't seem to get that reaction.
Nope. That's because I think that this is the greatest example that you have in this country of a topic that we've been raising consistently on the show, which is the new American fascism. Corporations are controlling the game. The polling that I've seen suggests that most Americans believe, and I have to think that that also comprises most NRA members as well, that they're in favor of sensible gun legislation. Nevertheless, the NRA, in fact, represents gun manufacturers, period. It doesn't really matter about the individuals who pay the dues, I don't believe. And what we are fighting for here are for gun manufacturers. I think we need to understand in this country that Smith & Wesson, Colt, Sig Sauer, Walther, Glock are all more important than any of these children who are being murdered senselessly almost every week in this country right now.
Let me ask you something. We also talk a lot about on this show about news media coverage. Do you think the news media coverage, either having it or not having it, is going to make a difference? Or has this just become so normalized? It's politicians lying where, of course, there was a school shooting.
Well, you've heard me often use the expression bread and circuses in our new fascist era. This is the sensationalization of these murders. Now, this is something that by the way, that I deal with quite a bit in African-American studies historically over the presentation of black bodies. Subjugated black bodies through various forms of media, be that human zoos back in the day or other forms of media, minstrelsy, for example, the spectacularization, the sensationalization of the event. These have become events, if you will. And then, to me, they're no different than circuses. The media is not, by reporting this, and obviously they have to report it, but clearly the way that they're reporting it isn't doing anything to push the needle on progressive action going forward to end these senseless deaths. Right. I hate to begin our show on such a lovely note, but this is what we deal with here at Project Censored.
That's okay. All I was going to talk about was how much I hated Bay Area traffic, so it's right. This is a little more valuable.
Right.
Yeah. Amy, out of curiosity, you've been the majority of your high school years in this as well. What's your perspective on growing up with this as the new norm, school shootings?
I have to say, thinking to my own high school experience, it seemed that I was kind of in a lull in the cycle as far as the shootings. They seemed to be gearing up as we in the recent past. And I was in high school 2002 to 2006. So I was younger when Columbine happened, definitely did not have a grasp on the magnitude of such an event other than it was such an atrocity. It was horrible. But pretty quickly forgotten. I just graduated from Diablo Valley College, and I've spoken with fellow classmates who are still there and hearing that they're experiencing lockdowns on campus, closed campuses because there's been threats of violence. It's just a whole new world.
Active shooter alerts. You got to get used to the active shooter alert.
It's turning in almost into a war zone where we... Basically, what we're seeing on the news elsewhere in the world is kind of coming home, but it's not hitting home. The gravity of the situation is just lost on most people, especially because it's not tangible. You can't relate to it. The odds of you being in that situation are so low that you're just like, oh, no, I feel for these people, but I'm not really going to do anything after that point.
These active shooter alerts are becoming as ubiquitous in schools as the duck and cover during Cold War.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, it's going to be just as common as an earthquake drill.
Correct.
In California.
Yeah.
Nick, I wanted to ask you this, because we always get accused of racializing everything on this show. So
we do?
Yeah. I want to racialize
this. I didn't know
this.
That was coming up in the listener mail.
So have you been following Killer Mike at all in his conversation about guns?
Yes, I have.
Do you want to share with our listeners kind of what he thinks? Any of your thoughts on that?
Well, I try to pay attention to him on – he's a very articulate guy. I try to pay attention to him on Bill Maher's program where he was trying to explain this. I'm not entirely sure that I understand wholeheartedly his logic. What I do appreciate is that he is entering into the dialogue, if you will. But what he's suggesting is that when liberals push for certain anti-gun legislation, okay? And specifically here, what we're talking about is an increased police presence on schools, for example, that there's an impact, a differential impact here for students of color. So that you do something with the good intentions of stopping school shootings, let's say, but then you wind up with something else like the possible incarceration or mass incarceration, I should say, of students of color on their school campuses for a host of other offenses because you've essentially created a police presence, sort of an occupied presence. And I think that he's reflecting a lot on the recent history of metal detectors and policing within predominantly black schools. As we know, schooling still remains, in spite of the 1954 Brown versus Board of Education decision, schooling remains de facto segregated in the United States of America. So there will necessarily be a differential impact of one blanket policy, be that, like, imagine arming teachers, okay? For example, the Donald Trump proposal of arming teachers. How does that differentially impact kids in, say, a predominantly black school where you have predominantly white teachers and still have predominantly white teachers who are then armed and who are already were being exposed through social media to a lot of these teachers abusing their kids? I watched something a couple of weeks ago on Facebook. And again, you know, it took me a while to sift through and figure out whether this was fake news or not, where a teacher got up on a student's desk and started kicking them. But what happens when that teacher has a gun? That's the stuff that Killer Mike is trying to bring up.
Well, it's an interesting point because, as you mentioned, it's the escalation on top of an already violent scenario.
Correct.
Let's keep fighting fire with more fire and more Correct. Fire instead of finding some water.
More guns are always the answer in this country.
Yeah, never less. We call for less in legislation, mm-hmm. but yes, let's add more and more to that potentially volatile situation.
Mm-hmm. It's truly the cowboy up philosophy.
If I can't teach you one way, I'll teach you another. But I'm going to get the job done.
Which I love because in many ways, in a sort of ironic sense, because first of all, the cowboy is a complete myth.
That's what I was going to say. This is where the fantasy comes in,
it's
right?
It's a total fantasy. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the cowboy, the term cowboy is actually a reference to blacks who tended horses. The boy being key there, you know, the reference mm-hmm. to black men as boys. And through John Wayne and Alan Ladd and Shane, movies like that.
I got two words to say to you.
What is it?
Cowboy up.
We've created this into this mythos that is the only equivalent to that is the Japanese samurai epic. Neither one of these individuals, be it the samurai or the cowboy, were great people historically. And certainly cowboy goes back to a deeply racialized history, so we're throwing more race in here, Nolan.
Send your letters to projectcensorradio@gmail.com.
Or hit me on Twitter, at Dr. Dreadlocks, yes. Right. But in any event, these are myths that we've built, but everything continues to be, let's cowboy up. We got a problem? Get the six shooters, get on the horse, and solve the problem. It doesn't work like that. It just doesn't happen.
No. It can't sustain itself.
It can't.
No.
It can't.
All right. Well, we will be back after this short musical break with our guest, Dan Kovlik. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts, Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. We are now joined by Dan Kovlik, Dan Kovlik is a senior associate general counsel of the United Steelworkers, AFL-CIO. He has worked for the USW since graduating from Columbia Law School in 1993. While with the USW, he has served as lead counsel on cutting-edge labor law litigation, including the landmark National Labor Relations Board cases of Lamons, Gasket, and Specialty Healthcare. He has also worked on Alien Tort Claims Act cases against the Coca-Cola Company, Drummond and Occidental Petroleum cases arising out of egregious human rights abuses in Colombia. The Christian Science Monitor, referring to his work defending Colombian unionists under threat of assassination, recently described Kovlik as one of the most prominent defenders of Colombian workers in the United States. Mr. Kovlik received the David W. Mills Mentoring Fellowship from Stanford University School of Law and was the recipient of the Project Censored Award for his article exposing the unprecedented killings of trade unionists in Colombia. He has written extensively on the issue of international human rights and U.S. foreign policy for the Huffington Post and Counterpunch and has lectured through the world on these subjects. Dan Kovlik, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. There's so many things I want to talk to you about: international labor, globalization, also the Russia investigation. So I guess where I'd like to begin is kind of ask you, what are you working on right now?
Well, a bunch of stuff. I'm actually in Caracas this weekend. I'm observing the elections there. And then I'm going to go to Colombia and observe the elections there. So I'm kind of getting around everywhere these days.
Okay, so I wanted to ask, most of our, in our corporate media here in the United States, most of the foreign policy discourse for a while focused on North Korea, but the majority of it's focused on Russia and this Russia investigation. Have you followed sort of the corporate media discourses on Russia and election tampering?
Yes, of course. And I, of course, wrote a book called The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, which delves into a lot of that.
Yeah, it was a great book. Since you've written that book, where have you seen this story go? What do you think about the contemporary sort of conversation about Russia and corporate media here in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, I continue to be surprised at the vitriol with which people speak about Russia, which I just think is not warranted by the facts. And I don't see Russia as this great threat to democracy or to world peace, but it seems that there's almost an obsession to portray it as such, and that does not seem to have abated since I wrote that book about a year ago.
So, Dan, this is Nick Baham. I just want to ask you if we can put a little bit more meat on the bones here. Why don't you see Russia as a threat to our democracy? And in particular, I'm here thinking about the context we're dealing in around the Mueller probe of Russian collusion by the Trump campaign team.
Right. Right. Well, again, I've been following the Mueller probe very closely. And honestly, I just don't see much there. What has he come up with so far? I mean, first of all, he's indicted several people, none of them for actual collusion. The big catcher is Paul Manafort, and he's being indicted for financial fraud relating to Ukraine, not to Russia at all. The other ones, again, are kind of penny-ante things. No collusion has been brought up. We're kind of left with some Russian firm that was engaging in some sort of social media campaign that seemed to go both ways, that is, on different issues. I just don't see a lot there, certainly not, by the way, compared to how the U.S. intervenes in other countries.
Correct, yes. Well, how do you feel, for example, about Russian incursion into American social media in order to move popular opinion headed into the election of 2016?
Well, again, first of all, you know that there was some Russian firm that definitely was participating in some sort of social media campaign. Again, it didn't seem at least pinpointed towards one candidate or the other. And I don't think any of the messages even mentioned candidates, more hot button issues. And again, they seem to take both sides of these hot-button issues. And the money spent on that social media campaign is very, very modest, especially compared to the billions of dollars spent by the candidates on their own campaign. So I just don't see it as truthfully a serious issue.
So, Dan, are you saying, and I think a lot of people feel like this, that any attempt at, let's say the Russian government did attempt to change the outcome of the election, any attempt they made, though, is sort of like a drop of dye in the ocean compared to other factors?
Yes. Yes, I would agree with that. You know, that, and again, compared to the U.S., who, by the way, if I can just mention, so I'm in Caracas right now, the U.S. has threatened to adversely impact Venezuela's oil industry if the elections go forward and Maduro is elected. Trump threatened the opposition candidate with sanctions if he even ran the campaign. That is real interference in another country's election. Twitter tweets and Facebook posts, I don't see that as serious interference.
Okay, so let's move down to Latin America. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit of what's going on in this election in Caracas, Venezuela, and why you're there?
Yeah, so you have a presidential election on Sunday. About five candidates are running, but there's two major candidates, Nicolas Maduro, who succeeded Chavez as president of Venezuela. And then there's an opposition, the main opposition leader named Falcone, who's a big business man here. He's running an opposition candidacy against Maduro. And then you have radical opposition that's boycotting the elections altogether. And that's where we're at. There seems to be a lot of enthusiasm around the election. There's real differences between the candidates. And I think there will be a free and fair election on Sunday.
Do Venezuelans, Dan, do you think, do they believe that they are voting in a free and fair election?
Yes. This is my probably fifth election that I am going to observe. And as I've observed, and others like Jimmy Carter, who's also spoken on this issue, Venezuela has one of the best election processes in the world. Very reliable, transparent. They have a uniform election system throughout the country where you have to use a fingerprint to even get the voting machine to turn on. And you then cast an electric vote. There has been a paper ballot receipt that you put in the box. And by the end of election night, a majority of all polling places are audited to see if the electronic votes match the paper receipt. So, I mean, it's a pretty incredible process that, frankly, we could probably learn a lot from here.
Yeah, I was just about to say that it sounds like something we should do. Do you know if the Venezuelans provide a national holiday for voting?
Well, it's on Sunday.
Perfect, yes.
So most people don't go to work on Sunday. So, and again, almost every country in the world has their elections on Sunday so that people can get out and vote.
We are talking to Dan Kovalik. He is a journalist, author, labor unionist, and he's talking to us while covering the elections in Venezuela. So, Dan, you said you've covered about the last five elections there. What sort of changes have you seen, either in a positive or negative direction, throughout those five elections?
Well, certainly some of them, particularly the one I witnessed in July, which was the Constituent Assembly election, there was certainly some violence that happened around that election. I believe 10 people died the weekend of the election. That was something I hadn't seen before, and thankfully it's something I have not seen since. That has largely calmed down a little bit. Hopefully that will continue to be the case.
What led to those deaths?
What's that?
What was the contributing factor in those deaths? Was there a particular political struggle or fight that you want to elaborate on that led to the deaths of those people?
My view is that there's a radical right-wing opposition here that has never accepted Chavez as president and certainly never accepted Maduro as president. And they've used violence as a means to disrupt society, and in that case, to actually try to disrupt the election. And it's the same people that are boycotting this current election and urging their supporters not to even vote. The irony is, if their supporters voted and voted for this opposition candidate, Falcone, they may actually be able to win. But they are sitting this out.
Interesting.
Dan, something we've been covering a lot on this show and it really is interests me is that I think particularly the younger people don't really understand like what journalists do and the dangerous places journalists go. And so for a moment there, you were talking about the violence you were seeing on the ground here. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what it's like for journalists in this contemporary climate, so how they're being treated, what threats they're meeting, not just where you're at now, but around the world.
Well, I think you're seeing probably the worst violence against journalists that I have ever witnessed. There's been journalists killed, of course, in Gaza recently with the protests. Journalists were clearly targeted to be killed. A number of journalists have been killed in Mexico in recent months. Colombia, some journalists have been killed. Honduras. I think it's probably the most dangerous time to be a journalist, especially covering international events like wars and that sort of thing. It used to be that journalists were kind of hands off or off limits, I should say, and that's not the case anymore.
Is it something you can see journalists feeling it, the chilling effect, just a different behavior of journalists themselves?
I don't know. I mean, it depends on what kind of journalist you're talking about. I think in terms of mainstream journalists, I think that there's probably less independent coverage of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. wars than it appears used to be the case. I mean, you now have journalists embedded with U.S. military forces, which obviously gives them they see things from the military's perspective in large case. But in general, I feel like the coverage, the foreign coverage, is very biased, I'll just say, towards U.S. foreign policy. And in a way, again, it's always been, but I think it's probably worse than ever, actually.
Okay, I also want to shift over to Colombia. You've done a ton of work there in Colombia, and Ben just brought us gold back in reporting of Colombia. So, and you said you're about to go to Colombia. What brings you to Colombia this time, and can you tell our listeners some things about the current state of Colombia?
Yeah, so I'm going to be observing their presidential election, which is on May 27th, and that's an interesting election that has a left-wing candidate named Gustavo Petro, who has a chance to win, probably a long shot, but he has a chance to win against a more right-wing candidate, Ivan Duque. And it's a real choice for the voters between a pretty left-wing candidate and a pretty far-right candidate. That'll be interesting. And all the candidates have been threatened with violence, and Petro himself survived an assassination attempt during his campaign.
Yeah, I wonder, Dan, is this just expected business? For example, a number of years ago, I lived in Chicago, and the violence in Chicago around politics was simply a part of the deal, right? There's a deep history of that. Is this just in both Colombia and in Venezuela, as far as you understand it, is the violence just a part of how business is done around politics, period?
Well, again, I think in Venezuela that has not been the case until the last several years, and again, I'm hoping that will stop. In Colombia, that is really the case and has been for a long time, most famously. In 1948, and everyone remembers this and talks about it all the time, a very popular presidential candidate was killed, a guy named Gaitán, and it led to what was called La Violencia, in which 500,000 people ended up being murdered. And so, and that was in 1948, and even since then, there's been a number of cases of numerous politicians killed, threatened, etc. So, in Colombia, it definitely is. Political violence is definitely par for the course.
Interesting. I wonder, too, Dan, if you would be willing to talk to us a little bit about your labor organizing in Colombia. I'm a union member, so just speaking union brother to union brother, if you could talk about that a little bit.
In terms of the work in Colombia, it's not as much organizing and helping to defend trade unionists under threat to try to, essentially by shining a light on their situation, trying to prevent people from being killed. Colombia has been the most dangerous country in the world for trade unionists for many years, probably since 1986 or so, with over 4,000 trade unionists murdered in that country. And so a number of unions, including my own, have kind of adopted the Colombian union movement to try to find ways to protect people. So that's really the work that I've done down there.
Interesting. So what is it that is so dangerous about trade unionists?
I think a number of things. I mean, first, obviously, they are viewed as a threat to profit.
because in the forming union and demand better wages, of course, that can impact the bottom line. And so they're seen as a threat that way, but they also tend to be political people as well, more progressive people on the whole, and good organizers. They're seen as a political threat as well. And actually, interestingly, over the years, the group most targeted has been teachers.
Interesting, yes.
Because of their social work in the community and their social value, which tells you a lot, again, about what's happening in Columbia.
Dan, we've got just about a minute left with you, and we'd like to give our listeners places to go, especially with when it comes to news overseas or foreign policy news. It's really tough here in the United States for a lot of people to find good place to go. So where would you recommend people who go who are interested in learning more about what's going on in international affairs?
Well, I do like Counterpunch. I think it's a very good resource. The Consortium News, which has a strange name, but that's a great source of alternative news. Of course, Project Censored is a great source of information. Those are really, and I'll say it, even though I'm sure people won't like me to say it, I think RT is pretty good, actually, on many issues and is worth looking at if you can find it, as well as Telesur English. Again, these are things that at least give a different view of what's happening in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Telesur especially has got some great stuff. I watch Empire Files a lot there with Abby Martin. Dan, thank you very much for coming on the Project Censored show and going out into these situations and bringing back the news. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's a real honor to be on your show. I'd be happy to come back.
We'd love to have you. All right, that was Dan Kovlik. You're listening to the Project Censored show. We'll be back after this short musical break. Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. And we just wrapped up that interview with Dan Kovlik, and we're talking about democracy and voting. I've been going around all these conferences talking about the death of democracy, and I argue we're already in a post-truth world. We need to stop talking about it. We're sliding into it. We're there. There's these recent polls have come out showing that Americans are choosing not to vote. About two-thirds of unregistered and unlikely voters said politics are just too corrupt to merit any attention. This was a new poll, and I got sort of two thoughts on this. One is I noticed there was a lot of polls about young people actually flirting with the idea that maybe democracy is not necessary. Mm. Is it that we've come so far from the fascist regimes of World War II era that people just think democracy happens naturally? Or my second question or thought is, have these powerful regimes hijacked democracy so well at this point now that we need to start thinking about things in a different framework?
I think it's both the both and, to be frank with you. And I think we've also forgotten that democracy is a daily practice. It's something that you have to do every day. It's like exercising. If you don't wake up in the morning every day committed to fighting for your rights and simply expect that the institutions will maintain a status quo where you have your full rights, well, you're fooling yourself. And I think that, people, frankly, have been bamboozled. I also think that people have made it very difficult, our institutions have made it very difficult to vote. And that is discouraging. Why don't we have a national holiday? Why can't we figure out how to have non-hackable machines? For example, where other countries are much more progressive in this. Even in Africa, where you can, they've instituted stuff where you can get the thumbprint, for example, to verify your voter registration, et cetera. Why can't we do that? And why can't we figure out how to vote on the internet?
It's politics, baby.
Yeah, we have these antiquated ideas of what democracy is. I always think we should do mandated voting, but in exchange, we give the option for you to do none of the above. So we mandate people to go, and if people don't want to make a say either way, they can abstain, but they still need to show up and participate.
Absolutely. You should be first of all, it's not just, you're right, it's not just voting. You should be protesting, because there's a lot to protest, okay? Let's be frank about that. You should be going to town halls. You should be going to city council meetings. You should be jacking up your local representatives and your state representatives and your federal representatives every day. That should just be a part of what you do. But, you know, let's be clear about this. Since the 1960s and the change in the economy since the 1960s, we are working overtime. All of us are working 60 to 80-hour weeks, okay, where we work at work and then we work at home. And by the time we're done, we don't have time for anything except some prepackaged food and sleep. And, of course, the common American thing are drugs as well. We have time for those things, too.
We always have time for our vices.
Always have time for our drugs, right. But that's it. That's the society that we're living in right now. And our news has become entertainment, bread and circuses. It's the full decline of the American democracy that we're living right now.
Well, and this isn't by happenstance either.
It's not. It's intentional.
And it didn't happen overnight.
That's right.
This is something that, like you said, is very intentional. It is systemic. Mm-hmm. It keeps the power structures in power and everyone else out.
They don't want you to vote.
And that is the purpose. Yeah.
Right. They don't want you to vote.
Because they know that you're not going to want to vote for them. If there is another option, we've been fooled into thinking that the two-party system works, even when it doesn't. And there's no other option. So now so many people are turning to, well, I'm not going to vote. But like you said, nobody else is going to fight for your rights. That's something that you have to wake up and do every single day.
Right.
Just as you do, get up to eat, go to work, go to sleep. Something you have to do every day.
That's right.
I'm so glad Amy just said that, though, about the two-party system. So I've had this dark, maniacal idea. But I think it totally, and I've already been told this, comes from a place of privilege. But I'm thinking if you look at like the Democratic Party, they're in such decline in the sense that they're losing all these seats, right? They're losing these seats and they're really banking on the idea that Trump is so horrible that people who would have not voted for Clinton who are not a Democrat will turn out to vote that way simply because they don't like Trump, not because they like Democratic Party politics. What do you think about the idea of just destroying the Democratic Party, letting them lose, letting them fail, as a way to circumvent the two-party system as it now stands?
Well, yeah, I think that what this country needs is a labor party. And I say this in part because I'm a union activist. But for me, especially the work that my union is doing in social justice and anti-racism transformation, labor is a way to bring us all together. I mean, in fact, some of the roots of right-to-work legislation are in racism. They're specifically about making sure that blacks and whites don't get together at the table and understand their common economic interests and fight together for those kinds of things. I would like a labor party that would transcend all of the differences that get manipulated, and they could certainly have been manipulated to perfection by the orange orifice who currently inhabits the White House.
So, okay, but that
a lot of color there, by the way, White House and orange.
Speaking of color, wasn't that kind of the message that came from the Bernie Sanders wing in 2016? It wasn't the counter-argument by identity politic leftists that if you use that class labor narrative, one, comes from a place of privilege, and two, doesn't address the issues faced by, say, people of color and women?
Yes.
And so how do you square that circle? It seems like it's a lefty firing squad in my mind here.
Well, again,
not to say they're wrong. I'm just saying it does seem like there's these two positions, and I just don't see where you can make them overlap.
So you're saying on the one hand the position of Democratic Party identity politics, and on the other hand the class-based argument?
It doesn't seem like there's a way to get the two to kind of come together to unite.
Well, for me, also because I'm still a Marxist, the class still is the overarching thing. Race is obviously the lingua franca of the United States of America. I don't think there's any question about that. But how do you effectively bring people together? If you look at American history, some of the most effective moments of bringing people from diverse backgrounds together have been around the kitchen table issues. Because whether you're black or you're white, you got to provide for your kids, you need schooling for your kids, you need health care. Well, these are things we need in common, that cultural differences notwithstanding, they're irrelevant in this respect. So you have to have class-based organizations that are also inclusive of the diverse perspectives of their members, that have to be fiercely anti-racist, anti-homophobic, anti-sexist, etc. Oh my goodness, yeah. And to me, that's the only way to effectively bring those together. I think one of the best examples that I can give to you of this is what Fred Hampton was doing in the 1960s, the leader of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, where he was bringing rural whites from Illinois to the table with poor blacks in urban Chicago. So not only do you have ethnic difference here, but you have the bringing together of this other polarization that we're dealing with in America now, small town, rural versus urban.
Well, I think you really hit the nail on the head with that one. It's we all need to eat. We all need to sleep. All need shelter.
That's right.
We all need health care. Those are the issues that we all need, regardless of our background.
You want to see like a unifying space? Go to a cancer care center. That thing hits all of us. No matter what your religion is, what your race is, what your sexual identity is, whatever, all those people want a cure for that, and they all want the right medicine for that, and they're unified in that sense.
Sorry, I'm Jessica Forrester. I came in a little late, but I do have a comment about the finding just our basic needs and how those are more important. I think just for our youth, and just I'm a college student here, so I find more interest in things that I need to get done, like say for instance my rent or my car note or my insurance. When it comes to the politics, things are happening every day that we can't control. We don't know how to control, how to even understand it in a way, just from just being young, because we don't know. And it's just that having a Labor Party would definitely be more influential and more where people like us can be able to be more involved, not just be ignorantly voting for whoever is more popular, whoever's saying the coolest slogan here or there.
That's right.
That's how I feel like, in a way, Donald Trump, people just liked him. The youth who don't know about, even what he said comments beforehand, probably voted for him because he's just who he is and don't know about.
He's on television.
Exactly. Yeah. So he's a common figure. We know who he is, what he's talking about. We're comfortable with him as the youth. So just if people would have voted for him, it could have been because of Ben. Definitely, we could benefit from that in our whole society.
There's definitely an argument to be made that that's why a lot of people voted for him, because of The Apprentice and watching this person with this sort of can-do spirit. But this is something we talk about consistently on the show. That's a television program. It doesn't have anything to do with your health care, your food, your education, yada, yada. It nothothing.
Well, and we've also been fooled into thinking that reality TV is reality.
Exactly.
Very much. You know? Very,
yeah,
very
focus on the TV part and not the reality part.
Yes.
And reality should really be in quotes. I'm doing quotes here in the studio.
That's what I mean. It's what I'm saying. We're in the post-truth society. People keep saying, how do we avoid sliding into it? We're there. It's already there.
Yes.
The question is how to get out of it, not how to avoid getting into it.
Yes. We've gone fully down the rabbit hole.
Right? That's our depressing message here from the project.
We've got to find a way to get back to Kansas.
We need Snake Plissken to pull us out of it.
Call me Snake. I don't give a about your war or your president.
Yeah, what a perfect figure. Yeah, yeah. I love that reference.
I'm lost. We're gonna take a musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. And as we've been talking to you guys about for the last couple months, the Project Censored team is working on creating a documentary on fake news. Like all or many of the Project Censored projects, it is student-focused. That is, students are the ones doing the work on the ground. They're the ones designing this project, doing the interviews, editing it. This is a student-made project. And we are lucky enough to be joined by Chelsea Corby of CSU East Bay. That's California State University East Bay in lovely Hayward, California. Chelsea is graduating this year with her bachelor's degree in communications. And she has led a team that has done the interviews at California State University East Bay for the documentary. She's done extensive studies in fake news and media. Chelsea Corby, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so tell our listeners a little bit about this team you've led. Who's on the team and what have you been doing? How have you been organizing these folks to get these interviews and footage?
The team so far right now is made up of me and about five other interns, and we all collaborate on getting together and performing interviews, making sure that the filming setup and everything is right, making sure that all the questions are being executed properly, and just communicating about what the documentary is and what the purpose is behind it.
This can't be easy. I mean, you're wrangling together not only the other folks who are working on your team, but also the academics you need to interview, and you're getting footage in classrooms. I mean, how do you manage all these different people, players, and places?
I've definitely utilized Google Doc and keeping tabs with everybody that way. It helps making sure that once we do something and I think about it right then and there, I'll email my team and let them know this is what we're going to do.
Well, actually, real quick, you're talking about all this work you're doing. How much are you getting paid for this?
None.
Oh, all volunteer work. Okay.
All volunteer work.
A labor of love.
So, I always like to bring that up because always this narrative of young people are lazy and not doing anything. And here this has got to take a lot of your time and energy, what you're doing here.
Yes. Yeah, it's definitely taking a lot of my time and energy because along with that, I'm balancing my other classes and work. So that definitely makes it pretty difficult. But it's worth it because I have a passion for this and it needs to be talked about. And talking about fake news needs to be done because it's the best way we can come up with solutions to combat it.
So I would just want to ask you, sort of as a filmmaker who's directing this, what your vision was before you started it. And I guess this academic or professorial question for you, what is your thesis?
If I had to answer what my thesis would be or what the purpose behind this
project. That was deep.
It was a deep question.
You cut right through.
If I had to basically explain my purpose behind this, it would just be for people to watch this and get a new perspective, especially from a younger generation, of why it's important to pay attention to fake news, what it is, how we can combat it, new ways of media literacy, and things like that. So I don't necessarily have a one-line thesis, but my purpose behind this is to inform others and to find new ways to combat fake news and create media literacy and new thoughts.
So essentially it's a work of empowerment.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
I like the solutions focus, I think, is critical as well, because we've studied media for years, and a lot of those media classes, I remember as a student, I would just kind of leave depressed. Man, there's no hope. Mm-hmm. But the solutions component, I think, is key in the work you guys are doing. So how many interviews have you done thus far?
So far, we've done, I think, three, and we're performing about five other today. We're doing a lot of interviews today, especially because there's a lot of people focused in the same area today on campus. So we're doing a lot of the interviewing today.
So can I ask you, obviously I've just asked you what your thesis is, so can sort of continuing along an academic line, what are some of the takeaways, things that I can put in my backpack and just roll with? Conclusions, for example, that you think that you're reaching in the film. You talked about helping students to discern what is fake news. I'm assuming that what's happening is that there are tools, there are takeaways. Like when I watch the finished documentary, there's stuff that I'm going to be able to take and just put in my arsenal, or backpack, if you will, and use in order to be able to discern what is fake news and what is not.
I think that especially with the faculty questions that we ask the professors, our interviews, there's sections within the interview that I believe will ask, what do you recommend, or in your past, what have you observed? So I think that that's going to be really helpful for people to take away once they watch the documentary, is learning from experts. The faculty take their time and they research that. Nolan Higdon, who he's writing a book about this things right now. So
yes, the prolific Nolan Higdon. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. So
I find his work amazing, and if I was a listener, I would definitely go out and get it. But that's just me.
He's controversial.
Yeah. So Chelsea, are there any common threads in those conclusions that you've seen in the interview?
Fake news.
We've all used Nolan's interview as an example. I think that coming from and taking a conclusion from his interview, definitely looking to the past really helps a lot. So I think that one thing that Nolan does is he really ties in the way that history has led up to where we are now. And then you can really reflect, why is it the way that we are in the position that we are? And then how can we come from this to something better? So I think that that's what I took away. And I think that that's what's really awesome about interviewing, is that people will take different things from it. So I may interpret it one way, but someone else can interpret it a completely different way. Essentially, you're asking what the conclusion could be, but I really don't know. That's for other people to decide. I truly hope what my intention would be is that people would take a – they would finish watching the documentary and feel a bit of inspiration and think, I'm ready and I know what fake news is and I want to learn more, or I already have some information on how to become more media literate, but I want to learn more. It's just really all about people find inspiration.
One of the things that's been bothering me is that the fake news is getting into the classroom too. And I wonder if you've had any discussions on that. I walked into my Malcolm X classroom last week, and the students wanted to talk about Kanye West. And why? What is the point? Kanye's clearly crazy. So what is the point of taking up that kind of space? And I wonder if that's coming up at all when you talk to professors about how fake news itself is getting into the classroom.
So far, I haven't had that happen yet, but from my own experience lately in class, I've experienced that as well. When I interviewed Nolan, I wanted to bring that up to him and ask him about Kanye West and how that's playing into the entire thing. And while I don't have the transcript with me, he did give a really interesting insight into it. So like you said, it's entering into the classroom. I think that it's an important part of the discussion to address that that's there, but find a way to incorporate that into the solution. We should probably start accepting that some people are going to always bring that up, but we need to find a solution and a perfect way to combat that, to steer people into the right direction,
right,
on the right path.
News that is meaningful.
Yeah, not
fake
news.
Not any, yes.
Well, what I'd add too, right, that you have, we didn't teach any critical media literacy to our students 20, 30 years ago. Well, that's now the generation that our educators, so not only is it students bringing in the classroom, I would argue quite darkly, that even educators are bringing it in the classroom as well.
Yes, absolutely. And wasting students' time with stories that don't matter.
True. Yeah. So, Chelsea, what I want to ask you as well is that you're kind of in this interesting position, right? You're a young person who's not only a media consumer, but also a media producer. You seem to be aware of these problems with the media that's out there. So how can you talk a little bit about how learning about more responsible media consumption, how it's tied to being a more responsible media producer, or vice versa?
I think that my education so far at Cal State East Bay and learning media literacy and definitely taking classes with Nolan Higdon has helped me with this. But I think that learning how to become media literate, I approach the situation when I'm interviewing people a little bit differently. So when people answer questions or they're in a specific space where they're a little unsure, I am empathetic and I remember when I was in that place as well. And I remember when I didn't know the things that I knew now. And so I try to just inform people while I can.
Well, you're doing an incredible work, and we appreciate all the work you're doing and can't wait to see what you guys produce here. Thank you very much for coming on the Project Censored Show.
Thank you for having me.
All right, we'll be back with a short musical break. Back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. And Amy is here to tell us more
This is Amy Casey of the Media Freedom Foundation with just some of the stories we are currently working on. From San Francisco State University, Ken Burrows and his student, James Guler Rogers, have nominated a validated independent news story that is a story ignored by the corporate press but covered by the independent press, titled U.S. Responsibility for New Nuclear Arms Race with Russia. The article examines the oversimplified corporate media coverage regarding Russia's new class of nuclear weapons that are designed to bypass U.S. anti-ballistic missile defense systems. By focusing on the new Russian systems while failing to mention the prior U.S. military expansion, as well as the withdrawal from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty, public discourse in the U.S. obscures the United States' role in starting this new arms race. That can be found at projectcensored.org. From the University of Vermont, Robert Williams Jr. and his student, Moira Feldman, have nominated a validated independent news story titled Russiagate, the Two-Headed Monster of Propaganda and Censorship. The article illustrates how Russiagate, which began as a scandal over Russian efforts to sway the 2016 U.S. election, has since proliferated into a drama of dossiers, investigative counsels, Russian adoption cover-ups, and beyond. By utilizing a sensationalized narrative, corporate media coverage of Russiagate reflects the hostility towards Russia, which serves to connect legitimate political protest in the U.S. with Russian operatives and interests. The full story is available at projectcensored.org. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners to go to projectcensored.org/radio. There you can access free content and show your support for Project Censored. You can also rate and like us on iTunes. It is a big help. Also, any feedback can be directed to Twitter. Nolan is at Nolan_Higdon, Nick at Dr. Dreadlocks, and Desiree at Des_Blacktivist. I'm Amy Casey, and that's the news that didn't make the news.
All right. Thank you very much, Amy. You've been listening to Project Censored Show. I'm Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts, Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are our executive producers and other co-hosts. Amy Casey, great job doing the special announcing today. I'd like to thank our guests, Dan Kovlik and Chelsea Corby. Mitch Scores is our amazing director and engineer. The Project Censored Show airs on nearly 40 stations around the U.S. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Send us an email at projectcensoredradio@gmail.com and visit our website online at projectcensored.org. where you can find the archives of all of our radio shows for the past 7+ years, as well as 40+ years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty. Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies of God.